tweet at TodaySOR.
Yes.
Now, my next guest is a cancer researcher, a physicist and a science writer, and he has just published a book called The Irrational Ape, Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. Dr. David Robert Grimes, you're very welcome to the studio. This book is full of fascinating stories to illustrate your argument or your arguments. Now, to explain what you mean by critical thinking that can save the world, just tell us about that opening story in the book. It's about a Soviet army officer called Stanislav Petrov.
Yeah, this is a terrifying story. And if you go through the history of the Cold War, you find loads of these. But Stanislav Petrov was just a duty officer in a Russian bunker in Moscow during the Cold War. And it was September 1983. And he was there working his job, and suddenly they got a notification that 5 American missiles were inbound. Now, this particular bunker happened to be home to the OKO, which was the Soviet early warning system. Now, what he was supposed to do was to ring up high command and say, nuclear war has begun, retaliate. And what the Russians would have done then, or the Soviets at that stage, would have been to launch an answer to that barrage. It would have been all-out nuclear war and a devastation on a scale that we can't even imagine. Now, as we know, that didn't happen. What happened was Petrov looked at that data and said, something's not right about this. If the Americans were going to attack us, why only 5 missiles? We could shoot them down. They'd need to hit us with everything they got. And while everyone in this crucible of pressure was screaming at him to call up high command and stop ceding the advantage to the enemy, he went, no, I'm not going to do that. He reported it as faulty. Now, he was absolutely correct. It turned out that it was reflections from low cloud. But instead of being rewarded for that, he was actually reprimanded and eventually kicked out of the military. So, interesting.
Yes, and had he... He wouldn't have been criticised if he had followed orders, but he mightn't have been around for too much longer.
Well, and nobody else either. Indeed, yes.
Yeah, and you continue with a description of a decision that did, in fact, end in disaster for millions of people, a decision to kill off all the sparrows in China.
It was an interesting one. So, when Chairman Mao and the Revolutionary Party took power in the late 1950s, they had this vision of how they were going to make China very modern, especially in agriculture. And they wanted to get rid of vermin. They wanted to get rid of rats and cockroaches and flies, which is reasonable enough. But to this rogues gallery, they added an interesting element, the humble Eurasian tree sparrow. And the reason they added that was an interesting one. It didn't actually vector any disease or cause any harm, but the bird itself was viewed as a capitalist exploiting the work of the farmers by taking their grain without contributing to the production of that grain. So they were viewed as public animals of capitalism is the translation of the expression. And they were incredibly efficient at exterminating them. They killed over 1 billion in a year by banging pots and pans and terrifying the poor birds till they fell out of the sky dead, or shooting their nest, breaking their eggs. Really, really efficient. The only problem was that they actually did play a role in the ecosystem. Their job was to eat locusts, and without them, locust populations exploded and they metastasized all over China, massively contributing towards what is called the Great Chinese Famine, between 15 and 45 million people died. And the worst thing about it is they had warning of this. The actual scientists in China were saying, well, hang on a second, these birds do help control our insect populations.
Yeah, and I mean, that kind of political tactic you discuss in the story, it's that something must be done, this is something, therefore this must be done.
Yeah, the politician syllogism, it's unfortunate. And we still see it today. We see knee-jerk reactions to things that aren't very well considered. And the problem is the situations we face in the modern world, whether it's climate change or anything else like that, or vaccination policy, requires considered policy. And if we're all going off the back foot and just looking to do something for the sake of doing it,
look how busy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't want to point fingers at anyone, but sometimes the consequences are incredibly detrimental.
Yeah. Now, of course, we don't always believe everything we are told or are sold by politicians, but you make the point that the principle isn't always to persuade, but to overwhelm us with conflicting narratives until we end up sleepwalking into a state of confused inertia. You better give me some examples of that.
Unfortunately, I hate to use the name, but Trump is a classic example. Trump is a graduate of a school of big lies. So he doesn't have any concern about internal consistency. He lies at a furious rate, then he'll tweet out things that we know are not true. But we're so overwhelmed by it, the actual feeling we end up with is apathy. And unfortunately, demagogues across history have used that. Napoleon famously once said that the only figure in rhetoric worth studying is repetition. And we see that with disinformation online, not just political disinformation, but things about healthcare.
Mind you, somebody as respectable as John Hume, I often heard him say that you have to keep, like a good teacher, you have to keep repeating things until they sink in with the people you're trying to persuade.
And that's absolutely true. The problem is when someone starts doing it with falsehoods, then it has, instead of in reinforcing that knowledge, it just creates this malaise.
Oh, but you see, in politics, your truth is my falsehood.
Well, that is an issue for sure. But there are things that are objective. And we have to agree on basic facts. We can always disagree on how we react to those facts. But if we have to be able to be cognizant of the fact that things are...
Yeah,
objective or not.
You deal with the logic of conspiracy theories, particularly those around, and today happens to be the 18th anniversary, the 9/11 hijackings, which have a large following. Just to take us through some of those.
So almost immediately after the smoke was rising over Manhattan this day 18 years ago, the cogs of the conspiracy machinery started turning. People started going, okay, this was a momentous event. We all remember it. But people started saying, there must be something more to this. And very quickly, in that kind of lack of information, that void, people rushed in to start filling it with whatever theory they really, really liked, or whatever group they already didn't like. If you already disliked one group, you'd blame them for it or something like that. And what has happened since the 9/11 truther movement is a loosely connected ideas of conspiratorial ideas that aren't always consistent with each other, but the only thing that they're really comfortable with is that there was some kind of conspiracy. And the interesting psychology of that is, it turns out, when you deal with conspiracy theorists, you'll often find their internal logic is not consistent. But that doesn't really matter. What matters to them is having a sense of superior knowledge about an event. And it also addresses how we deal with conspiracy theorists, which is an interest of mine for a good few years now.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of talk about fake news, and also sort of maybe a byproduct of that would be what you talk about being false balance in the media, particularly during public votes. Again, you better give me some examples.
Well, I'd probably give you one that's even more recent. We see it an awful lot with things that should be objective, like vaccination scares. We saw it, obviously, the classic example is the Andrew Wakefield MMR autism link, which was now fully debunked and does not exist. Yet in striving to present balanced coverage, some media outlets gave a lot of coverage to this discredited view. And if you are not cognizant of the fact that if you didn't know anything about vaccination, you would think, oh, there's two sides to this and maybe it's more divided than it is. We see it on climate change. We saw it here with the HPV vaccine recently when a public panic ensued in 2015 that brought vaccination rates down from 87% to 50%. And I was dealing a lot with vaccine hesitant parents who would say to me, well, I'm hearing this and I'm hearing that. So false balance is still a problem in this day and age, even with social media.
Yeah, but I suppose a lot can turn on whether you believe that there is such a thing as objectivity. And it's something you can say, you know, it doesn't exist, therefore you don't need to strive for it. Or you can say it does exist, it's just that you never attain it.
There's a kind of Nietzschean there. We get into the weird, is your truth my truth? I certainly, interpretation of events, there is always room for subjectivity. But basic measurements, if we use the same tools to make the same measurement or we observe the same events, we should be able to agree at least on that aspect.
Yeah, but I'm just looking here at the Irish Times today, page 5. Social media firms must decide which side they're on. That's Simon Harris, the health minister, and that's kind of, it speaks to something you referred to a few moments ago, that he says that the social media companies have to decide if they want their platforms to be on the side of public health or to be exploited by lies and disinformation. Now, you can see where his concern would lie, but he's also challenging fellow TDs not to allow themselves to be used, and that word is in inverted commas, by asking irresponsible parliamentary questions about vaccines.
And I know
move
who he's
on,
referring
nothing to see.
To
now. I mean, that's, you can see why he's concerned, but you can see where that could lead
absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely, but I'll give you an example of what the minister is obliquely referring to, without naming names, because we don't get anyone sued today. What actually happens is often when the facts are in about something, there's a technique that is just asking questions is the technique they call it. And that is when you, instead of asking a question, you're using it to cast out. So if I say, it can be a begged question, for example, when did you stop hitting your wife? That obviously that would be entirely loaded. And if you go and say my defense is, well, you know, no matter what way you defend that, you've already put the spectre of that idea in someone's mind. And we have seen with the HPV vaccine in particular, people standing up in the dole asking questions, but the questions already assume an answer. They already assume that this vaccine is causing harm. Like, what are you going to do about these damaged girls? And remember, we know this didn't actually transpire. So I see Minister Harris's point.
Yeah, but I mean, take another vaccine, the one that was given, and particularly to youngsters in schools at the time of the scare about the Russian flu, was it? And there are some people whose children were given that vaccine and then they began to suffer from narcolepsy, that sleep disorder. Now, again, that is
this
a connection that is...
Swine flu vaccine.
I beg your pardon.
No, you're right.
And which I think originated there in part. But in any event, people who had genuine concerns about what happened to their kids, you know, collapsing in showers and all the rest of it, I mean, they had legitimate concerns.
Absolutely.
But I mean, if you take the minister's logic, oh, well, we shouldn't be questioning this.
But to go a little bit further, I think that's an unfair reading of the minister's words, because in that case, the narcolepsy link...
I mean, one of his predecessors.
Absolutely, yes.
Not this
but with
minister.
The narcolepsy link, what was actually discovered, that was discovered by scientists who found it in masses of data. So when you give a vaccine to lots and lots of people, or any medical intervention, mm-hmm. you're always observing for side effects. So these early alarms were triggered by actual researchers. They weren't triggered by isolated reports. It was still a rare enough side mm-hmm. effect, but it definitely existed.
Yeah.
And like any intervention, there's a risk. What I'm saying is that evidence was objective. That was people coming up and saying, we've done the analysis on this and there's definitely something mm-hmm. going funny. We should take steps to correct
right.
that.
Right. And I suppose something like say, tobacco or cigarette smoking, you can't say that there wouldn't be a false balance if you gave equal airtime to people who tried to persuade you that smoking
is good
for you.
That actually happened, Sean. In the 1960s, there was a memo released by the tobacco industry, and I talk about it in the book, and it was called Doubt is Our Product. They suddenly realised that they couldn't compete with the weight of scientific literature saying that their product was carcinogenic, and they said, let's muddy the waters. Let's get people to say, oh, maybe there's a question about this. And it was a very famous memo called the Doubt is Our Product memo. And in fact, we see the same with climate change. We see fossil fuel companies often going, oh, well, we don't know about climate change if it's really man-made. Scientifically, we do. But if they can muddy the public discussion, we're all left inert.
Yeah, but you take something, say, like, you know, a referendum in this country. There's a statutory responsibility or obligation imposed on broadcasters by the Supreme Court to give equal time to both sides of an argument. Now, there's a referendum due, I don't know if it's going to happen this year or whenever, to change the Constitution and to remove that reference to a special value being attached to the work that a woman does in the home. I haven't got the thing in front of me here. But again, you could say, well, look, you know, where's the need for balance in that?
Oh, I would agree with you that I believe it's the McKenna ruling or something, was it? But
well, there's Crotty and McKenna and a few more in there.
See, all these things, and this going back to false balance, it always comes from a good place. Journalistic impartiality or political impartiality is a good, laudable aspiration, but it falls down utterly when the weight of evidence is unbelievably one-sided. Like, you wouldn't take someone in who is a Holocaust denier and put them beside a professor of Holocaust studies and say they have equal support for their views, mm-hmm. and yet... In striving to be fair-handed, that's sometimes what we do. And I believe with the vaccination thing you referred to earlier, that's what the minister's referring to. If the evidence is overwhelmingly one-sided and the other thing is essentially lies, treating them equally is a mistake.
Towards the end of your book, David, you quote the philosopher Karl Popper, we should claim, in the name of tolerance, the right not to tolerate the intolerant.
I do, yeah. The paradox of tolerance.
And, I mean, is that something that you adhere to, that view?
I do to an extent, because what I will often do is you go in online and you see this yourself. You have to work out if something you're dealing with is in good faith or not. So I often get, again, I'll go back to vaccines as an example, I get vaccine-hesitant parents. They're not anti-vaccine, but they've heard scary things. That conversation is in good faith. I can sit down with them and we can discuss mm-hmm. If I'm dealing with a dyed-in-the-wool anti-vaxxer who I know is propagating falsehoods, that is no longer a good faith discussion. Anything I say will be twisted and weaponized. Popper was referring to something similar, I think, when he said if someone goes out and they want to deny your fundamental humanity or they don't respect that good faith agreement that any discussion needs to pivot on, well, then it is a mistake to tolerate them.
And how would that sit with the phrase attributed? I'm not sure if this is undisputed to Voltaire. I wholly disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it.
So the Voltairean priest ritual, actually, it was his biographer that read the quote, but it would very well sum up what he said. And I love Voltaire. But he was, and in his writings, I have badly translated ones from French, he does actually specify and put the caveat on that this has to be in good faith. You don't sit there and debate with someone that only wants to lie and twist and meld around. So that was back in the 1700s, Voltaire was aware.
Much more recently, the question was posed by Maria Steen in a column in the Irish Times. What do liberals have to tolerate?
Actually, I replied to that column obliquely in the Irish Times a few days later. What do we have to, well, there was a kind of a twisting of what tolerance actually is. If someone hears your views and goes, oh, no, I actually find you reprehensible, that's their free speech to say that too. If you're trying to enforce your views on people and they're not willing, understandably, to have them forced on them, you can't then claim your free speech is being denied. Freedom of speech is not the same as freedom from consequences of speech. And sometimes commentators especially conflate the two. If people hear what you say and they think you're an idiot, well, say la vie, that's life.
So to come back to the subtitle of this book, one of them, How Critical Thinking Can Save the World. So where do we go? How do we start? What are the boxes we should be ticking?
Well, I think we really do stand on the cusp of an extraordinary era where misinformation and disinformation can perpetuate faster than ever before. And it bamboozles us. It totally confounds us. But we have the tools to deal with that. We've always had them. They're a little bit hard to learn. They're not intuitive, but we can learn them. We have to learn both how not to be misled by skewered rhetoric, the kind of tricks that demagogues, charlatans and fools can use against us. And I give several examples in the book because unfortunately history is replete with examples. And also how we can kind of steal the ideas from analytic thought and philosophy and scientific thinking and apply them to everyday situations and kind of go, okay, how do I ascertain if this information I'm being given is something I should pay a lot of heed to or something I should refute? And also, and the biggest freedom I'd say anyone has is that we should all have the freedom to be wrong. All of us are wrong all the time. And we have this weird identity protective cognition where we're married to our ideas. We need to get rid of that. And we need to embrace the fact we'll be wrong and flow with it and be willing to go towards being right. There's no shame
in
being wrong.
And to accept that other people can be wrong as well.
Give them the freedom to be wrong and also the freedom to kind of say, the only shame is in not correcting your views once you come across information that should correct them.
I think it was a Galbraith who said, when the facts change, I change my opinion. What do you do, sir? Have you ideas, finally, on how to convince the people who do not accept the science, who believe the information they get from other sources? I'm thinking particularly about something, say, like vaccines.
There is a good bit of research that's been done on this, and I touch on it a bit in the book. It goes back to establishing faith. For example, say vaccine hesitancy is a spectrum. There's a dyed-in-the-wool anti-vax cohort. You're wasting your time. But you don't need to concentrate on them. What you need to do is get the messaging out to people that are concerned, and you have to, in very good faith, deal with their concerns and their fears and show them, not just tell them, this is good or bad. Show them how we came to that conclusion. Show them why, the evidence right there, and let them come to their own. Give them the freedom to come there. And I really, truly believe that if you give people that open-handed, they will go there.
It's fascinating territory. David Robert Grimes, thank you so much indeed for coming in. The book is called The Irrational Ape, Why Flawed Logic Puts Us All at Risk and How Critical Thinking Can Save the World, published by Simon & Schuster. David, thanks indeed. We're talking autumn in the garden after this break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.